This episode, I'm joined by Eric Wargo, who is a science writer from Washington, D.C., with a PhD in anthropology and a professional background working for organizations and government institutes conducting archaeology, psychology, and neuroscience research. In this episode, we discuss his book, Time Loops, Precognition, Retrocausation, and the Unconscious. I'd like to thank all my patrons and paid subscribers for making all of this work possible, and if you'd like to support Emetics or become part of the community, please find links in the description below. Enjoy. So, Eric Wargo, thanks very much for joining us on Emetics podcast.
Thanks a lot, James. Great to be here.
So, we're going to be talking about your book, Time Loops, Precognition, Retrocausation, and the Unconscious, which is a work about it's primarily about time, but about the way we think about time, about strange things that have been documented about time, and things along these lines. So before we jump in with that, if you could just tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write this book and what it is you do.
Yeah, well, I'm a writer. I'm a science writer. And by day, I write about health and stuff like that. But I'm, for the past 10 years or so, well, actually more than that, probably 15 years, I've had a blog focused a lot on the paranormal and science fiction. And sort of via, in a sort of a oblique way, via the UFO topic, which is what I used to write about like 10 years ago, I sort of got into ESP research because there are a lot of interesting overlaps between these areas. And ultimately, I found the UFO topic to be a sort of dead end to write about. There's so much confusion and BS and personalities in the field that it's pretty much it's very hard to sort out what's what. But the topic of parapsychology really captured my interest increasingly. And whereas I'd always been kind of a knee-jerk skeptic about ESP, I'm not a hardcore skeptic, but I was never very trustful about ESP claims. But the more I read, the more I discovered that there's really something to this. But that, I guess the realization I had was that there's something there, but it's not being thought about in the right way. One of my interests is in sort of the history of science and the history of knowledge and sort of the way our understandings of complex ideas and scientific discoveries are kind of framed by our assumptions and by the metaphors that we use to talk about them. And I realized that the field of parapsychology is kind of lacking in that ability to rethink its assumptions and to really consider the metaphors that are guiding its thinking. And, you know, for like ESP has been dominated by metaphors drawn from telecommunications, for instance.
What's ESP?
ESP, extrasensory perception. Mm-hmm. It was sort of the category that was created in the 1930s by the Rhines, who were some researchers at Duke University who really wanted to investigate psychic phenomena scientifically, and so they gave it a sciencey sounding term, extrasensory perception, and they measured it and, you know, very extensive but very boring kind of laboratory tests, you know, using cards, you know, where you'd have one person looking at a card, another person trying to guess what card they were looking at, and so forth. And so they were trying to test, you know, what was then called telepathy and clairvoyance, the ability to see things at a distance. But the guiding concepts in all this research were drawn from telecommunications technologies, because the idea was, well, somehow this is information being transferred across space or broadcast across space. So like minds are somehow broadcasting their thoughts to other minds, you know. And this was, you know, the term telepathy emerged in the late 19th century, right along with the term telegraphy. You had the telegraph, and then of course the radio became a new model for how to think about ESP, and then of course television, and that sort of the television metaphor sort of dominated the idea of remote viewing, which is sort of this ESP modality that became popular in the 70s and that was studied as a possible way of spying on our enemies, you know, the psychic spy program in the 1970s. But anyway, what I was realizing as I sifted through all this literature was that, you know, there was clearly evidence for psychic functioning, but that these metaphors of signal transmission might be throwing off the researchers and throwing off people who are trying to think about this stuff. And so I tried to think about it in a new way. And the most persuasive and compelling way of thinking about it was as an aspect of causation and time, and the mind's relationship to information that it's going to acquire in its future. And so I've been sort of revisiting the literature on ESP and psychic phenomena as precognition, as you know, learning things that we're going to learn in or getting a preview of things that we're going to learn in our future, and being influenced by things that events and experiences in our future. And it turns out that, you know, that in physics, this idea is already taking hold, that the explanations that have been used for quantum mechanical mysteries over the past century, what's been missing is this notion of retrocausation or backwards causation. And so it all kind of meshes really well into a sort of overarching theory of how both physical systems are influenced by later states of those systems, as well as how our minds and our thoughts may be influenced by what's ahead, not just by what's, you know, what experiences we've already had. Mm-hmm. Sort of a long answer to your question.
That's okay. So a lot of things came up there, which I'm sure we'll dip back into. Specifically, you know, retrocausation and the idea of time sort of not being linear. But I like to get the Hermetics question out at the start here. So if you could place three thinkers, living or dead, into a room and listen in on the conversation, who would you pick?
Right. And I think you emailed me that question and I had a very clever answer and I don't remember what I said. Well, I can give you the boring answer and I can give you a more interesting answer. I don't know which one you want.
Yeah, go through them both. It's fine.
Well, the boring answer is I would like to get Sigmund Freud in a room with Carl Jung and the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, because my work is really focused on how precognition is a really super prevalent and important aspect of our minds, and that it's basically an unconscious phenomenon, and it maps perfectly onto the Freudian unconscious, onto what Freud was studying back in the turn of the last century. And pretty much all of the phenomena that he studied as symptoms of the unconscious, so dreams and slips of the tongue and all kinds of neurotic behaviors and so forth, that these can really be re-explained as aspects of our precognition. And so that's what time loops is about. Now, interestingly, the you know, his protege, Carl Jung, was really, I mean, Freud was not at all interested. Well, he was mildly interested in paranormal phenomena like telepathy, but that wasn't his main focus. But his protege Carl Jung was very interested in this stuff, in what we would call the paranormal, and in coincidences and in dreams that then seem to come true. Now, Carl Jung was writing at a time when there were really no appropriate models in physics to talk about this stuff. So he was sort of drawing on quantum physics and the idea of chance and randomness, and sort of he intuited that this would somehow help understand, you know, things like having a dream and then having the next day you encounter that thing from your dream. And so he developed this this theory called synchronicity. And of course, synchronicity has been very popular as a way of thinking about uncanny paranormal phenomena ever since then. And it's never been more popular than it is now. I mean, it's just, you know, synchronicity is everywhere these days in, you know, among people who think or write about the occult or UFOs or psychic phenomena. Carl Jung's word synchronicity is, you know, has proven very popular. My argument in time loops, though, is that Jung was kind of ahead of his time in the sense that he really didn't have a good physical model of how this works. And so he, since these events didn't seem like they could be explained causally, he said, well, somehow it's an acausal connecting principle that has to do with meaning and so forth. And that aspect of his theory really ultimately is very disappointing if you really want to understand psychic phenomena like precognitive dreams, for instance. But the theory of retrocausation, which is emerging and gaining ground in physics, really provides us with a better language for talking about these kinds of events. Now, famously, Freud and Jung had a falling out, partly over the question of paranormal phenomena and Jung's interest in that. This is one of the great events in 20th century psychology, was the falling out between Jung and his former mentor, Sigmund Freud. For that reason, I think it would be wonderful to get the two in a room to talk about this stuff. Now, I have a personal interest in the French psychoanalyst Jacques Lacan, who provided a lot of, he wasn't interested in the paranormal at all, but I find that his framework for understanding the unconscious actually gives us an even better language to talk about things like precognitive dreams and so forth. And he himself, all three of these characters were Lacan was very sort of eccentric and combative. They were all very combative people. So I think it would be very interesting to have a debate between these three people.
Okay, so that's a room, you know, you said that's the boring room.
Room.
Because they're all obviously of the same lineage, and it would be interesting as well to see how much Freud agrees with Lacan's return to his work, and whether or not he's on board with the symbolic, the real, and the imaginary, and the mirror stage, and things along these lines. But I am intrigued. If that's the boring room, what's the exciting room?
Sure, I remembered what the exciting room was. The exciting room was Phil Dick, number one, Slavoj Žižek, who I just love, and he sort of represents the Lacanian viewpoint. The Zen master Lin Chi, who people often know as Rinzai, who is a very sort of confrontational Zen master who would, you know, bark at his students and hit them, but his writings, there are not too many of them, but they're, some short writings, are just really very brilliant teachings in the Zen tradition. And I find a lot of strange sort of sympathy between the Zen tradition and the Lacanian tradition in psychoanalysis, and in different ways, these three figures are all Gnostics, but they're very different flavors of Gnosticism, and I think that would make a pretty interesting pretty interesting conversation.
In what way do you consider Žižek a Gnostic?
Well, he's a Gnostic without he's the most interesting Gnostic of the three because he doesn't think he's a Gnostic. He is in deep denial of his Gnosticism, and much of his work, I would say the first, his especially his sort of earlier writings in the 80s, 90s, is very Gnostic, but in denial of that Gnosticism. That's part of what I find fascinating about him, because, Phil Dick was a very overt Gnostic. Slavoj Žižek is desperately important for him to be a legitimate mainstream philosopher, and to not be New Age, and to not, to not embrace magical thinking and so forth. And yet his persistent obsessions are things like time loops and consciousness. And it's like this tension in him, this fascinating tension in him between something transcendent, but then his sort of professional need to be a mainstream materialist Marxist thinker. As a materialist, he's very afraid of anything that smacks of non-materialism. I think that there's a lot more going on in his work than even he would admit. And I have to say, when I'm talking about Slavoj Žižek, I'm sort of talking about this Slavoj Žižek of the 80s and 90s. I mean, he's sort of turned into the kind of Jabba the Hutt of philosophy. He's not quite as interesting these days. I mean, he's provocative, but I like the early Žižek a lot.
Yeah, I'm sort of skeptical of any philosopher who can produce at that pace and still retain some sort of originality, especially when you're writing books about the coronavirus that, within months, there's a lot of repetition going on.
Yeah, at a certain point, his books just became rehashes of his old books. He's sort of, ripping on the same themes. So I'm less interested in his more recent work. Although I just find him always entertaining, even he's a good palate cleanser for for everything else.
The Gnostic Žižek would make one hell of a book. I'd love to see the arguments there.
Hey, it's a book I would love to write, and I feel like I could write it if I had the time. The trouble is I just don't have the time. But it's there. There's definitely a side to Žižek that he doesn't acknowledge, but that really speaks to people like us who are interested in Gnosticism and the occult and challenges to materialism in one or another.
I imagine these thinkers probably will come up again, probably all of them in some form. But jumping into the theorizations of time, the first question I have is a really big one, and it's sort of important to me as well, which is actually not really to do with the theory of time in itself, but actually our sort of social reaction to it. And you have these two concepts, precognition and retrocausation, which I'm hoping you can sort of expand just simply what they are. But both of these move towards theorizations of time which aren't linear or non-linear. And what is it about this idea of non-linearity or non-chronic time in a certain sense, which people find so almost like disgusting, and they're quite hostile towards this idea? What do you think it is about that why people are so almost afraid of it?
Yeah. Well, first of all, what are precognition and retrocausation? They're essentially the same thing, but viewed from different sides. Retrocausation is simply the idea that an event can exert an influence, a causal influence, on something that precedes it in time. And I should say, first of all, that we're really not talking about time being nonlinear. Time is just a dimension, like the dimensions of space. But our experience of time and the Enlightenment's assumptions about time are that events only flow in one direction. Mm-hmm. And that's been codified sort of in the, you know, laws of thermodynamics and so forth. In fact, one definition of our of time has been sort of the one-way flow of entropy, of things flowing from order to disorder. But mathematically speaking, and in terms of physics, time itself is just a dimension. And what the retrocausation idea is that causality is not just unilinear. That yes, there's this sort of thermodynamic regime of causation that tends to produce events flowing in a single direction that we experience as the arrow of time. But that on the most fundamental level of interactions between particles, there is no causal directionality. That this sort of this arrow of time, this unilinear direction of causality, is something that emerges at higher levels as an effect of entropic interactions sort of spreading through a system. And so at the most fundamental level of interactions, there's no causal directionality and no temporal directionality. And this is something that's now being demonstrated in quantum computers, for instance. You can scale up this kind of eternity or this eternalism that governs the most fundamental levels of interactions. You can scale it up in certain kinds of systems, such as a quantum computer, where you can have logic operations that unfold in reverse, in temporal reverse. Theoretically, you could have a quantum computer that produced an output before an input. And this, I am arguing, is a lot more important and relevant than just this kind of rarefied situation of a quantum computer circuit that, in fact, biologists have been discovering for the past 20 years that living systems are quantum computers, in a sense, that these quantum that life scales up the quantum spookiness of interactions at the smallest scales. That life is a way of scaling those effects up, and there's a lot of for the last 30 years, there's been a sort of an effort to find how the brain might be essentially a quantum computer. And the impetus has been to understand consciousness. I'm not really even that interested in this question of consciousness. I mean, I think precognition is an unconscious phenomenon, not a conscious phenomenon. So consciousness to me feels like a distraction. But I think when we understand how nervous systems behave as quantum computers or as hybrid, some sort of hybrid quantum classical computer system, that's going to explain phenomena like precognition, getting information about our future in dreams and in involuntary reflexes and so forth. So what was I kind of lost the thread of the question?
Why are people hostile towards?
Oh yeah, why are people hostile? Well, the moment you start talking about precognition and retrocausation, well, first they're hostile. First of all, because it's difficult. It's really, really, really hard to think. It's hard to think about causality at all. You'll find, certain people who are sort of trained in maybe a scientific or engineering or sort of technical career, or maybe people who are historians and so forth, they have an intuitive understanding of causality, and they're able to think about complex causal relationships. But most people find causality and causation to be, a little hard to grasp. And this is just a human, we're not good at thinking about causation, first of all. And when you throw in retrocausation, that really, really throws us off. And so it's very sort of unpleasant to to try and wrap your head around effects that precede their causes. But then, okay, for people who are open to this idea, the first thing they realize is that this throws into uncertainty, I guess, our cherished beliefs in free will and the ability to control our destiny. And because what it implies is that there is a future that somehow already exists that is influencing us in the present. And while we may not have a problem with that at the level of particles and material interactions out there in the world, we don't like to feel like we are being controlled by something ahead of us. This notion of free will is very deeply ingrained in us as Westerners. It's a very Western kind of philosophical assumption and need that we have. It goes along with our ideas of freedom and responsibility and so forth. So people balk quite strongly when they think about a future that somehow already exists acting back upon the present because of this free will thing.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting, going back to what you were saying about quantum computers. I mean, my background is continental philosophy, so my sort of trajectory with regards to the theory of time is basically springboards from Kant, who obviously completely altered for the future of philosophy since his day, and going on from Hume's idea of that we can't know about empirical causality to the understanding that any understanding of causality that we have is subjective, and our spatio-temporality that we exist within is subjective, and that is because we have to process the world or cognize the world or we represent the world. Represent the world in a certain way. Now, to put that idea forward, could we then begin to understand a quantum computer as having its own subjectivity with respect to how it intuits spatiotemporality?
I have no idea how to answer that question. You're talking about a quantum computer as an artificial intelligence. Is that what you mean?
What I'd say is that if a quantum computer can functionally work with time in this the way you say, in that it can produce an effect before a cause which then difficult to think about time. If a computer can produce something in B which actually then causes its own cause, so something in B which then causes A, that would be an argument to say that the way in which that computer deals with time is different to the way that humans have to deal with time.
I'm still not understanding your question. I think there are two issues here. There's that how we think about time and how we manage time versus simply causation. And we don't have to understand how this is working for it to work. So for instance, I can have a dream that causes that is influenced by an event in the future, and I can take an action based upon it, which in some oblique way leads to the event that I dreamed about, and then realize, oh my gosh, information was flowing backwards in my head. I wasn't aware of it at the time, but it flowed backwards in my head, and it led me in a roundabout way to take the exact course of action that needed to happen for that event that I dreamed about to occur. So there doesn't need to be, the brain doesn't need to be managing that in some sort of conscious way, which is why I consider this an unconscious phenomenon. So I guess I hear you asking about whether a quantum computer could, I don't know. I don't think that a quantum computer needs to know what it's doing. Or to have a consciousness of time for these kinds of retrograde effects to be important. Am I misunderstanding your question?
No, that makes sense. If it's devoid of consciousness, then it would be
separate from the way in which humans sort of deal with time. But it does bring forward a big question, which is, you know, why is it that there's only certain moments where this happens for humans, and why isn't it able to be sort of consciously controlled? I mean, as you say, it's unconscious, but why do you think that is, and what do you think that is? I mean, I know that's very abstract.
No, that's a great question. In fact, that's what my it's really the kind of the question that my Time Loops was attempting to answer, and that my next I have a forthcoming book called Precognitive Dreamwork and the Long Self, which is now you can now purchase it on Amazon. It'll be out at the beginning of the year. It takes forward this question to sort of the next level. This is the important question. The part of the reason it has to be unconscious is because consciously we're constantly trying to exert what we think of as our free will. You know, we're trying to, act on information in a way that, you know, produces good outcomes and prevents bad outcomes. And, you know, if you had a clear, I'm just trying to think of an example. Like, you had plans to you had plans to drive to your grandmother's house tomorrow, you know, and so the night before you have a very vivid dream of crashing your car and dying on your way to your grandmother's house. And the next morning you decide, I'm not going to take that trip to my grandmother's house. So there's no option for that event to happen. Well, that's actually not how it works. That people imagine that that's how precognition works, but it's really much more complicated than that. What we precognize is thoughts and emotions in response to events that actually occur. And, you know, those thoughts and emotions reflux backwards, and they are symbolically represented in our dreams. But we never know exactly, like, even if you have a dream that you're sure this is God, this is a premonition somehow, you'll never, ever know exactly how that event is going to unfold. You'll very typically misinterpret it, and very often in a way that gets you to take the course of action that turns out to produce the event that you were dreaming about, and you only realize when the event happens, oh, that's what that dream meant, or that's what that symbol meant. And, you know, 9 times out of 10, a premonition of something disastrous turns out to be, in fact, a misunderstood, just precognitive dream about something very banal and trivial. That's not a disaster. I mean, the dreams that rise to being written about in ESP books and so forth, about, you know, premonitions of dying in the Titanic or whatever. I mean, these are like very, you know, very small percentage of the vast majority of precognitive dreams. I argue in this upcoming book that really all dreams are probably precognitive. This is probably a basic function of the brain, but it's always going to be couched in symbolism. It's always going to be indirect, because if we had clear sort of video quality transmissions from our future and we knew exactly when these events were going to occur, well, then we could take actions to prevent those things, and that would be a paradox. So that would just never occur. The way information has to reflux into the past in a quantum computer like our brain. I think our brains are essentially tesseracts. They're these four-dimensional information tunnels, essentially, through time. And the way information has to flow in retrograde through a tesseract is in an indirect, symbolic way so that our actions lead to the experiences in the future that influenced us in the past. And thus, that's why I say that we are essentially built of time loops. Our lives are essentially built of these time loop formations. And these are not rare occurrences. It's rare for us to notice them because we're not looking for them. But when you start looking for them, it's pervasive. And I've got examples of a few like precognitive dream workers who, you know, are applying this idea, and it's utterly mind blowing how pervasive this is in our lives once we start paying attention to it. And I think a lot of people, that are interested in these topics are paying attention to it on a certain level. They're paying attention to it on this level of synchronicity. You know, they're kind of mentally armed with that concept that they've taken from Jung, and so they're alert to things like coincidences in their lives. And so that's a start. But once you understand how it works, cognitively and physically, you can start to really, really see its operation throughout your life on a daily basis, and start to work with it in really interesting ways. And so that's what the upcoming book is designed to do.
Yeah, I mean, there's not so much assumptions, but some conclusions that can be drawn from that, which are somewhat, I guess some people would see them as scary, but they're interesting in that, you know, you put forth this idea that if you had video grade quality of exactly what it is that's going to happen, then you could change the thing and therefore it wouldn't happen. So, and you know, you'd have sort of a multiplicity of multiple people, attempting to alter their future all at once, which would then, of course, much like the film Primer, which I imagine you've seen, you keep going back and it begins to fragment off into this just absolute infinitesimal sort of shotgun of different time paths. And it seems that it wouldn't be able to work that way. Right. So does that sort of conclude that there is a definite future in a way?
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. the view that this leads towards is of the block universe, which is an old view. It was formulated by Einstein's math teacher, Hermann Minkowski, after Einstein's initial formulations of special relativity. Minkowski sort of put together that, well, what this means is that time is a dimension-like space, and that you have this thing called space-time as this sort of four-dimensional construct. And this, no one has ever been able to kind of move past or disprove this theory. I mean, you'll find that most physicists adhere to it. But because it's so hard to think about retrocausation within a single dimension of time, they either reject, you know, they just don't even want to think about this possibility of retrocausation. So it's taken about a century of quantum physics to kind of come around to it. It's never been disputed, really, in any, I don't think, well, it's been disputed, but it's never been, I think, disproved or moved beyond, in physics thinking. And yeah, I'm very much an opponent of multiple timelines kind of thinking. And you get this again and again, science fiction writers, because they balk at the idea of a single timeline, because of the conceptual issues are so troubling, they immediately resort to the sort of fallback position of branching universes and so forth. And it's been codified in physics as the many worlds interpretation of quantum mechanics, Everett's many worlds theory. And that's sort of become a mainstream popular position. I think that it's a total wrong turn, frankly. You know, here I am, non-physicist, you know, telling physics they're going in a wrong direction. I know I'm going to sound like a crank, but I think my money is that that the retrocausal interpretation of the quantum measurement problem replaces this many worlds. You no longer need this many worlds idea. and that science fiction writers should really be more resolute about trying to keep their time travel stories within a single timeline continuum, because it's much more interesting that way. You know, the best time travel stories really don't resort to that parallel universes thing. It's much more interesting to confront the issues of time travel and retrocausation within a single timeline. I'll say that there's the idea of a single self-consistent timeline was sort of codified by a Russian physicist named Igor Novikov in the 1980s, and his self-consistency principle really it was sort of taken and it was tested by a couple of students of Kip Thorne at Caltech, the great black hole expert. And they sort of did the math and found that it's true that if you have their model was a billiard ball going through a wormhole into the past and trying to deflect itself away from the wormhole, they'd find if you shoot a wormhole at its earlier self, the math always works out that it will actually deflect its earlier self toward the mouth of the wormhole later, so that you always have a self-consistent universe. You always have what's called a closed time-like curve, which is what I call a time loop in my book. And so history will always be self-consistent, even if it includes time travelers. And this is what I mean by our lives being built of time loops. And I think that this is the explanation for, and this is bringing it back to psychoanalysis, this is the explanation, this is the real explanation for the symbolic nature of the unconscious and why dreams manifest symbolically. They bring us information about our future in an oblique, symbolic fashion, because only then will we misinterpret those dreams in precisely the right way that we have those experiences in the future that we were dreaming about. And so my new book is essentially taking sort of the theoretical framework for my new book is taking, you know, Novikov's self-consistency principle, which was designed to explain wormholes, and merging it with Freud, because I think that explains symbolism. It explains meaning. You know, I like to say that meaning follows straight paths in curved cognitive space-time, which is sort of a paraphrase of Einstein's idea that light travels straight lines in curved space-time, and that's how you explain gravity and the curvature of space. I think the same thing's really happening cognitively, with a brain that's a tesseract, that's a brain that is bringing us information constantly from our future. That information has to reflux into the past in an oblique, indirect way, and that's what we call symbolism.
Mm-hmm. Just as a digression, sort of almost frustrating for me as someone with primary interest in philosophy, that you mentioned Einstein, and I think I personally put, historically, people such as Descartes or Leibniz, these would have been understood primarily as scientists now, but they are understood primarily as philosophers because, for whatever reasons. And it used to be that science and philosophy and other areas would all feed off each other and actually try to understand each other. And it's interesting, like I said, that you mentioned Einstein, because there's this sort of infamous Einstein-Henri Bergson debate where Bergson really lost. And came out of it very badly. And it seems that that can almost be placed as this point where they really separated and began to not really listen to one another, or at least science began to not listen to philosophy. Because the frustration is that what you're talking about is found in countless philosophers, especially of the continental tradition now. And it doesn't seem, you know, because of its abstractness as a, I guess it's a relatively risky word in this context, but because it's a metaphysics and not a science, it's not taken seriously, and yet that we're talking about the exact same things here. So now these innovations or these new understandings in science and quantum computing, as you say, of time loops and retrocausation are abstractly being put forth by thinkers before that, I would argue. But the huge question for me with regards to this is understanding it almost as, I guess, as a system, because there's almost like a dark implication here for me in that what is the place of decision within this? You know, so if time is making sure certain things happen or certain things are going to happen, but they are influenced by the future, which is almost like, I don't want to anthropomorphize it, humanize it, but it's almost like a way of saying that we need from the future, we need this bit to happen. And that seems to me like a decision. So do you think that to a certain degree, time can actually be seen as an intelligence with a maybe even a clear teleology?
Yeah, I believe in teleology, but the difference between the teleology in the sort of contemporary retrocausation framework is that there isn't necessarily an intelligence guiding it. It's not like God's, higher understanding that's deciding things or willing things to be, but things are do tend towards an optimum. When you have a quantum computer system, there is a natural selection effect that tends to produce optimal persistent outcomes. Things tend to survive. This is one of the reasons I love this framework, is because there's an implicit Darwinism in it. And it's kind of a selection effect, drawing things toward optimal outcomes. But whether there is a big intelligence at the end of the universe that's part of that, it's fun to think about. I don't think you need to have that there, although I think I'm basically sympathetic with that idea. So it's kind of teleology. Well, actually, the physicist Wheeler said he called it teleology without teleology. And that's I guess how I would put it. It's sort of, it's teleology, but it's not necessarily intelligently guided in the sense of that theologians would might assume. I mean, it could be, I think you definitely can create a model that sort of synthesizes this kind of intelligent purpose based on a future superintelligence acting back on the past. That's definitely possible. And I kind of personally love that idea, but I don't know that it's necessary here.
No. I mean, there's one thing I was going to say is I'm heavily sympathetic to that idea. And to be honest, consider that intelligence to actually already be here. And I consider it to be capitalism, because it makes the most sense to me that is the thing which is, fits all these markers extremely well. And is a very unique system in the way that it can be fluid, but we won't get into that too much. One thing, I mean, it's a pretty basic question, but what alterations do you see this having on man's being and also his meaning within the world? I mean, once you no longer have linear time as it's understood, and you no longer have causation as it's, in the common sense reality understood, big structures like meaning and what it is to be man, because the passage of life and then death. I mean, it's still there, obviously, but it is altered. So what clear alterations do you sort of see happening to man's actual sort of his being and his purpose?
Well, the huge implication of this is that it really reframes your understanding of what it is to be a person, because implicitly we go through life thinking that, well, I am my consciousness or whatever right now. The past is gone. And the future is uncertain, and so that we think of ourselves as who we are right now, and that maybe we're dealing with baggage, or we're dealing with a sort of momentum from the past, but that the past is gone. We tend to think that way, and we don't think of the future as somehow having an importance for us, except for as someplace we'd like to go, Well, the reframing that I'm offering, my new book is called Precognitive Dreamwork and the Long Self. The long self, this idea of the long self as a unity from really from birth to death, really reframes how you think about your life. And when you start to, and the reason precognitive, you know, working with precognition, it gets you in touch with that and makes it tangible in a way that, you know, you can think sort of conceptually about your life as a unity from birth to death. But when you study your dream journal and realize that, you know, 30 years ago, you had a dream about an event that happened today, an important event in your life that happened today. Mm-hmm. When you have that experience, and this, believe it or not, you can have this experience. I mean, I've got, it's really amazing when you start keeping a dream journal over the course of decades. When you start having the experience that, oh my God, all of your dreams, you know, were, or not all of them, but you have dreams that go back to when you were a youth that were about something happening, you know, right now. You know, like I'm 53 and I had dreams back when I was in my mid 20s that were about things that are going on in my life right now. That is a mind blowing idea. And by extension, you realize that, well, that means that who I will be in, you know, 10, 20 years, I hope, you know, 30 years, whatever, events still to come are somehow shaping me right now. Mm-hmm. When you start to have that sense of yourself as this unity that's, and of your, you know, brain or your consciousness, whatever, as a kind of a tesseract, extending through your whole life, you know, this certain length of time through the block universe. It's really a mind-blowing alteration of your sense of self. And along with it comes this kind of Zen-like, we wanted to bring it back to Zen a little bit, becomes a Zen-like kind of setting aside of these ideas, these hang-ups we have, not only about free will, but of related ideas, like you mentioned, decision. I think that decisions and intentions are, in fact, misinterpretation of precognition. I think that we misconstrue, you know, our premonitions of our own future successes as decisions and intentions, and that a lot of our belief in free will is based on this complete misunderstanding of our own cognition. It's kind of a satori that you kind of have when you've worked with this enough. And it's why, you know, I encourage people to, who are troubled by the whole free will implications of all this, to just work with it, sit with it, meditate with these ideas, and you will sooner or later start having really profound shifts in the way you understand yourself and the world.
Do you think that one's interaction with these ways, you know, meditating, journaling, dream journals, and one's acceptance and understanding that this is the way things are, affects that path, or is that path, in your opinion, completely set?
Yes, it affects the, I mean, causes do work. I mean, things cause other things. So yes, a change that occurs in my life now has repercussions in the future. But stepping back from that, those changes are already, they're already set. They were already set. And it is the way we experience and explain to ourselves these experiences, like making a decision or having or making a choice or having an intention and following through with an intention. It's those ways of framing those mental processes that is incorrect, and that a future, you know, human who's enlightened about this will reflect on that error, you know, the way we reflect on other sort of cognitive errors and superstitions of you know, earlier times. I think it's a transformation, and it's an evolution that's awaiting us to kind of reframe our understanding of the self and our life in the universe in this kind of larger kind of eternalist way. And I, you know, this again, I always, you know, make a pitch for Zen, because Zen meditation really kind of is a fast track to having these kinds of enlightenment experiences. And honestly, if you read the, you know, the Zen literature, you know, Zen people are often kind of shy to actually describe their kenshos and their satoris, but when they do, they're having direct sort of insight into this block universe. I mean, if you wanted to describe a typical satori, if there is a typical satori, they are kind of sort of firsthand experiences of the block universe, and they're very blissful. You know, it's like if you haven't wrestled with these ideas long enough, it sounds awful somehow for the future to already exist and so forth. People are just, you know, find that's repugnant. But when you work with it and you start having these experiences, it's like there's nothing more astounding and beautiful. I mean, it's just incredibly sublime. It's overpoweringly sublime.
Is there anything you would like to add, or you think it's important that we've missed out?
Well, I mean, we could keep talking about this stuff for hours.
Yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah, this is always the realized. I guess a good question would be, where, if anyone wants to sort of, like you say, have a fast track to these, to begin understanding this, where would you actually advise? How would you advise them to start?
Well, I would make a pitch for my forthcoming book, which is called Precognitive Dreamwork and the Long Self. It's coming from Inner Traditions, publisher in early 2021, and it's already available for pre-sale on internet sites. So I would encourage them to start there, because it really gives instruction in working with the dream aspect, especially. But it also goes into other, it goes into a little bit meditation, lucid dreaming, trance state, active imagination, that kind of stuff too. There are a lot of ways to sort of get at this, synchronicity, so forth. So I would start there, and but you know, you can I don't know where to tell people to start with the Zen tradition. I just did a lot of reading in Zen literature. You know, everyone starts with the simple stuff like Alan Watts and Suzuki and the other Suzuki, but getting into the real Chinese roots of Zen was a real huge thing for me. There's some really great translations by Thomas Cleary and his brother of the great Zen classics that just, you know, will just blow your mind and really helpful as an accompaniment to a meditative tradition or meditative practice.
Okay, Eric Wargo, I think that's a good place to finish up. Thanks very much.
Thank you. This has been fun.